Hello, and welcome to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Pavel Butorin, a producer at RFERIL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, we go to Pakistan, where a correspondent for our Radio Mashal traveled to a remote valley to investigate claims made by an American TV news show that schools funded by American author Greg Mortensen are either empty or non-existent.
Our sisters are studying at their doorsteps. Previously, there was no such possibility.
In our Meet the Bloggers series, we talked to analyst Liz Fuller, the author of the Caucasus Report blog on our English language website.
One of these examples was the story I wrote about conditions and torture in secret prisons in Chechnya. And I don't recommend anyone who doesn't have a strong stomach to read this, but someone had to put the information out there in English.
I sit down for a chat with Mustafa Sarwar of RFERL's Radio Free Afghanistan about what seems to be the first large-scale Facebook movement among Afghan university students.
This is, I think, a very strong start for the young population of the country to let the government at least think about their demands.
And I visit once again with the editors of our bureau's Wire, Merhad Sharibjan and Pete Baumgartner, for another edition of our regular Uncovered segment. We begin with a story from Pakistan. Greg Mortensen, the author of a New York Times best-selling book, Three Cups of Tea, is now beset by charges of fraud. His book has been accused of inaccuracies and exaggerations. The number of schools he built in Pakistan has been brought into question. But how do things look on the ground? A Pakistani journalist, known as M. Shah, traveled to one remote valley of northern Pakistan to find out. His special report for RFERL's Radio Mashal is narrated by Jeremy Branston.
One thing you quickly learn when you visit remote Ishkoman Valley in northwest Pakistan is that nobody here seems to know the name Greg Mortensen. But they do know the name of the charity he heads, the Central Asia Institute, or CAI. That is very different than in the United States, where the author of Three Cups of Tea has been much in the news lately. In April, CBS News' 60 Minutes reported on allegations that Mortensen's charity spends more money on publicizing his books than on building schools. The news show said when it looked into or visited 30 of Mortensen's schools, it found some performing well, but roughly one half were empty, built by someone else, or not receiving support at all. So, this month, Radio Mashal sent a correspondent to one of the many remote valleys in Pakistan where Mortensen claims to have built schools. With hundreds of schools in hard-to-reach places, we couldn't hope to check out more than a few on one trip. So, we chose Ishkoman Valley, 24 hours by car from Islamabad, at random. As our reporter entered the village of Imit, home to some 500 families, he hailed a man by the road. "Are there any schools built by Greg Mortensen here?" he asked. The resident, Shaukat Ali, gave a blank look. The foreign-sounding name clearly rang strange in the man's ears. We asked instead if there was any school built by the Central Asia Institute, and this time an answer came pouring out.
I have known about the Central Asia Institute for the past 2 years, and they set up schools in different areas and run these schools in a good manner. They recruit good teachers, and they are doing a good job in the interest of this region.
In fact, the school was just a little farther along the road. It is the Imit Higher Secondary School, a 7-room building made of concrete with a tin roof. Dulat Ali, the head teacher at the secondary school, says the building was constructed in 2001. The money was provided by a European Union grant through the Aga Khan Education Service. But in 2010, the secondary school was expanded by the Central Asia Institute to include a 2-year college, the first in the region. One of the students, Jehan Bibi, who comes from a village elsewhere in Ishkoman Valley to study here, says women in particular benefit.
Our sisters are studying at their doorsteps. Previously, there was no such possibility.
She says many traditional families are reluctant to send their daughters out of their own home region for schooling. The fact this college is still geographically within their network of relatives means women can get permission to study there. Beyond Imit, the villages in Ishkoman Valley become few and farther apart as the terrain gets steeper and harsher. Some 10 kilometers further north, we come to the village of Majawir and spot a billboard beside the road. The sign identifies a nearby building as Majawir Village School and says it is also funded by the Central Asia Institute. Majawir Village School is empty of students, but the staff explains that is because the school is currently in recess after holding exams. Still, there are plenty of signs the single classroom is used regularly. The room is carpeted, and the walls are hung with teaching aids divided by disciplines: science, arts, music, and history. A teacher tells us 82 boys and girls study at the school, and that there are at least 6 teachers. He says the Central Asia Institute pays the teachers' salaries, while the village itself contributed the land for the school and constructed the building. In Tishnalut village, 15 kilometers up the valley, we find another school funded by the Central Asia Institute. It is also closed following exams, and workmen are busy building a boundary wall. But we learn that when it's in session, 60 students attend, taught by 2 teachers who are paid by the institute. Back in Imit, we meet the institute's regional representative, Saidullah Baig, who is on an inspection tour from Gilgit. He says that throughout this corner of northwest Pakistan, the Gizar district of Gilgit-Baltistan, there are 19 projects either completed or underway. He also expresses shock at the American television news story, which has raised doubts about his organization's work.
We do not do much promotion, but you can see for yourself what we claim to do in any area that is on our list.
It is not possible for a journalist to visit all the schools on Baig's list in a short time. Given the difficulty of the terrain, that would take weeks or months. But it is not only the CBS News report that today hangs over the Central Asia Institute like a cloud. Here in Pakistan, a national Urdu-language internet daily, K2, has reported the charity is in trouble for reasons similar to those cited by CBS News' 60 Minutes. It reported that one of Mortensen's first local partners, Ghulam Mohammed Parvi, has taken over one of the institute's schools in Skardu district, in the west of the sprawling Gilgit-Baltistan region, and now charges the students tuition when previously they received education for free. The publication also reported that Parvi has rented to a university a dormitory building which the Central Asia Institute constructed to house impoverished students. RFERL was unable to independently verify those allegations, but they are in line with charges leveled by critics in the United States that the charity's management structure is disorganized and lacks oversight over many of its initiatives. To get to the truth of such charges will require more trips to the roof of the world and months of digging. But if a pattern in Mortensen's story seems to emerge from this quick ground check, it is a pattern of both successes and failings. Today, if the Central Asia Institute seems to have trouble overseeing its activities, so does the public in overseeing the charity. Until journalists, both in this region and in the United States, can piece together a fuller picture of how well the charity works, the concerns about it are only likely to persist.
That was a special report from our Pakistani service, Radio Mashal, narrated by Jeremy Branston.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast.
In the following segment, Meet the Bloggers, we introduce listeners to the correspondents behind the bylines. In this show, Grant Podelko, a regular host of this podcast, talks to Liz Fuller, who focuses on the caucuses.
Liz, welcome to The Blender.
I'm happy to be here and to talk about one of our most unruly areas.
Well, the caucuses is an area that not everybody's familiar with. Can you sort of give us the nickel and dime tour?
Well, geographically, it's the area sandwiched between the Black Sea in the west, the Caspian Sea in the east, Russia to the north, and Turkey and Iran to the south. Within that space, you have dozens of different ethnic groups with their own languages, not all of them living on very good terms with their neighbours, some of them Muslim, some of them Christian. In the south, you have the independent states of Georgia, Armenia and Azerbaijan. You have the three breakaway republics that are in a state of legal limbo, Abkhazia, South Ossetia and Nagorno-Karabakh. And then you have the seven republics in the North Caucasus, Adygea, Karachaeva, Cherkessia, Kabardino-Balkaria, North Ossetia, Ingushetia, Chechnya and Dagestan. What they all have in common, of course, is that they were all two decades ago part of the Soviet Union. They're all struggling to come to terms and to overcome the Soviet heritage, authoritarian leaderships, you know, stagnating economy, corruption, inter-ethnic tension. In the North Caucasus in particular, over the past 10 years, you've had the rise of militant Islam. And of course, all these factors are factors that Russia is seeking to control, or in the case of the South Caucasus, to take advantage of to try and reimpose its control of the region as a whole.
And how did you become so interested in the Caucasus?
This is so serendipitous that it's almost embarrassing to admit it. At the age of 18, I applied to the University of London to study Russian. One of the professors on the selection committee asked me out of the blue, "Miss Fuller, would you be interested by any chance in studying Georgian?" All I knew about the Caucasus at that stage was from reading the 19th century Russian novelist Mikhail Lermontov's little collection of stories called A Hero of Our Time. And basically, my picture of the Caucasus was as a wild, rugged, romantic region. And I knew intuitively that this was something I wanted to do. And I said yes, without hesitating. And I've never regretted it for a moment.
The rest is history.
The rest is history.
Now, it seems like, at least in the West, when the Caucasus are in the news, it's usually Chechnya. And it's usually like Kadyrov, Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen leader, you know, building soccer stadiums or doing something crazy. But you don't necessarily write about those things. How do you select the things that you write about in the Caucasus report? What are the criteria that you choose?
Basically, I write five different sorts of stories. And I try not to go with, you know, the most obvious news stories. The first category is breaking news and analysis. A group of Chechen fighters attack the Ramzan Kadyrov's home village. What does this tell us about how strong the insurgency is? What does this tell us about how weak Kadyrov's position is? What can we expect to happen next? This is the fast and dirty sort of analysis. The second category is the sort of polar opposite. You know, taking an in-depth look at the situation. I did this most recently, I think in March, when Medvedev nominated Kadyrov for a second presidential term. And I looked at the way how Kadyrov is slowly and insidiously consolidating his control over the whole of the North Caucasus, to the point that you can almost say he's the third most powerful and feared person in Russia. Then the third category is what I call the smoke detector category. If I'm reading constantly about a region and I think, hang on, something's going on here, there's a crisis brewing. The story I'm working on at the moment is about how the de facto president of South Ossetia is preparing to bend all the rules so that he can serve a third presidential term when his term expires in November, the way that Nursultan Nazarbayev did and Ilham Aliyev in Azerbaijan. I'm not sure whether he's got Russia's approval, and I'm not sure how things are going to turn out. But, you know, this could get messy. Watch this space. The fourth category is when I read something that is so outrageous that I write in a, you know, out of sheer moral indignation. One of these examples was the story I wrote, I think, in January about conditions and torture in secret prisons in Chechnya. And I don't recommend anyone who doesn't have a strong stomach to read this, but someone had to put the information out there in English. More recently, I was outraged when the Georgian government said it would not act on a European Court of Human Rights recommendation for a reinvestigation of the murder of a young Georgian banker in 2006 by some Georgian Interior Ministry personnel after the young man got into a heated argument with a group of people in a nightclub who happened to include the minister's wife. And the final category is what I would call the self-indulgence category. This is when I find two or three intriguing pieces of information that I think fit together, and I deploy my skills as an old-style Kremlinologist, trying to piece these pieces of information together and come up with a coherent picture, the same way that an archaeologist would sit down with the shards of a Mycenaean pot and try and stick them together.
Wow. Thank you. Well, thanks, Liz, for appearing on The Blender.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And you can find the Caucasus Report and all of our other blogs on our English language website at referl.org.
This was Grant Padelko speaking to our Caucasus analyst and blogger Liz Fuller.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
А ще Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатицюн ГТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
My next guest is also a frequent blogger on our English language website. Mustafa Sawar is a broadcaster with Radio Free Afghanistan, but he also writes for our website, for our English language website. In fact, I invited him to the Blender studio to talk about his recent blog entry that caught my attention. It's great to have you back on the Blender, Mustafa.
Thank you very much indeed.
So we're here to talk about Facebook. Facebook, in a country that our listeners perhaps least expect to have an active Facebook movement, Afghanistan. In your blog, you talk about the emergence of a political movement on Facebook. So tell me a little more about this movement, how you found it and how it came about.
3 months ago, I started a new program called New Thinking, which is geared at youth and young people. The key goal is to give the young population in Afghanistan a voice and to bridge the gap between them and the government. Because in Afghanistan, more than 60% of the population of the country is under 25 years of old. I found them actually on Facebook while I was creating a website for my program, and then their existence actually on Facebook caught my attention, and I contacted them and I found a spokesperson of this movement.
What's the name of this page of this movement?
The name of the page is The Reformists. And
that's a pretty ambitious name right there.
Of course, yeah, in Afghanistan, which really needs reforms.
How many participants does it have at this point?
According to Asar Hakimi, the spokesperson of the movement, there are more than 6,000 members and activists working for this movement on Facebook, and also they have active sessions in Kabul and other big cities in the country.
So you said you talked to Mr. Hakimi. Why don't we listen to a soundbite from that interview?
The fundamental problem in Afghanistan is that on the one hand, the Afghan government is plunged into corruption, and on the other hand, we have not seen an active opposition group with a clear goal. The young people who are members of the reformists insist that we need to create a group that is an active political group against the government, and one that has a clear goal in order to be trusted by the people.
Do you think they are close to achieving that goal?
Well, it's very difficult in a country like Afghanistan, but this is, you know, the beginning, and I think it's a very good start because the government, in which there are many conservative leaders who have not heard the voices of the young people in Afghanistan, they are kind of, you know, resisting these kind of movements, or sometimes, as the young people say, do not listen to their demands. But this is, I think, a very strong start for the young population of the country to let the government at least think about their demands. In a way, this movement can have its impacts on the government to bring change and reform.
And this movement is obviously inspired by similar movements on Facebook as well across the Middle East.
That's right. Mr. Hakimi told me that they were basically inspired by what was happening and is happening in the Middle East.
At the same time, they're different. How are they different from those movements?
Of course. The movement is a bit different from what's going on in the Middle East, because they say we're not trying to change the government, or our key goal is not regime change in Afghanistan, as we witnessed in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Tunisia or other countries. They say we are going to convince and pressure the government. 3 months ago, they sent an open letter to the parliament demanding the removal of the ministers of higher education and education, and also the minister of culture and information.
Was there demand
on the
met?
Allegation? Not yet, actually, but
at least their voices.
Their voices. They raised their voices. This was, you know, the first example ever in the recent history that I remember in Afghanistan.
So what's next for this movement? Do you think it could potentially become a political party?
This is what they are aiming at, because in Hakimi's words, he says that we are going to become an active political party against the Afghan government. We are striving to have clear goals and objectives and strategies in order to be trusted by the people of Afghanistan, because he says that in the past people were, you know, involved in revolutions, in coups, and or they were kind of conservatives, which people did not like them in the past. So they say that we are going to be more civil movement in order to have impacts on the government.
Great. Well, in the meantime, we'll keep logging on Facebook and refreshing their page. Thank you very much, Mustafa. That was very interesting.
It was a pleasure.
And now it's time for our regular segment we call Uncovered. This is where we look at some of the best original reporting coming out of RFERL's local bureaus. Once again, I am joined in the studio by editors Pete Baumgartner and Merhat Sharibjan. Hi, guys. Welcome back.
Hi. Hello.
You two represent one of the busiest desks in the newsroom. Stories keep coming in from our local bureaus, and a lot of them are pretty unique. I just had Mustafa Sawar of the Afghan Service on the show speaking about a Facebook movement in Afghanistan, of all places. And I saw a story on your wire about a Facebook activist in Azerbaijan getting a jail term. Can you tell me a little more about it?
Yeah, sure, Pavel. Yesterday, a young opposition activist in Azerbaijan was sentenced to 2 years in prison, allegedly for evading military service. He denies that charge, and it turns out that he's the one that was the organizer of the March 11th Great People's Day, in which was organized on Facebook, and which got people to click to say that they supported the anti-government protests, and it also encouraged people to meet in different towns and cities and to lead protests against the government. And now suddenly he's been sentenced to 2 years in jail, and he says it's because of those Facebook activities.
Okay, another story that caught my attention is another disturbing report out of Belarus, where a former presidential candidate is in jail, and his family apparently doesn't even know where he's kept. Is that true, Merhat?
It is true and not true. His wife, we're talking about Andrei Sannikov, who was sentenced to 5 years in jail on Saturday, May 14th, for organizing mass disturbances, which were in fact protest action against the official results of presidential elections. Sannikov was sentenced to 5 years in jail. His wife was sentenced, received a sentence in 2 years in jail, but the verdict was suspended and she was allowed to stay home. And that the same day, on Monday, she got a special written permission to visit her husband in KGB detention center. But when she came there on Wednesday with her mother-in-law, Alla Sannikova, the KGB detention center people said, Sannikov is not there. And they didn't say anything about his whereabouts. So they, two women were shocked and started searching for him in other detention centers in Minsk. Nothing came out. And when they wanted to even call KGB duty officer in the beginning was trying to say that they had nothing to say about it. In the end, he said that he probably is still in KGB detention center, but he doesn't know why his colleagues gave erroneous information about his whereabouts. It reminds me very much of the Soviet time when not only political prisoners, but just prisoners were deprived of all their rights, and their parents or relatives, wives and husbands, who had no idea where their relatives are kept.
Well, I'm sure we'll follow that story in the future, and it's interesting to see how the story develops. And now to Moldova. Our Moldovan service reported on what appeared to be an anti-Muslim rally in the capital, Chisinau.
Yeah, exactly, Pavel. Hundreds of Moldovans came to the streets in the capital Chisinau yesterday, and they protested against the fact that a Muslim organization was registered by the government. It's the first Muslim organization to be recognized by the government, which then gives them an official platform there. And some of the people who were in the march, they said such things as that this recognition of the Muslim group would open the door to terrorism, and would lead to mass conversions to Islam. And they said that they had to defend their Orthodox faith. Most Moldovans are Orthodox Christians. One person said that Muslims are like a virus. If you let in just a few, they will multiply, is what that person told our service.
How many Muslims are there in Moldova?
Well, officially there are only about 2,000, but the Islamic League, this is the organization that was recognized, they say there are about 17,000 in the country.
And wasn't there also some kind of counter rally?
There was, but unfortunately, at least if you're looking at to balance it out, there were only about 50 people that came out to support the more diverse society, and the fact that the Anti-Discrimination Coalition is what they were called, and they came out to support the fact that the Islamic organization was recognized.
Interesting. Officially. Thanks, Pete. And this next story is my personal favorite. It's about the driver of a top government official in Russia getting fired for aggressive behavior in a Moscow traffic jam.
Yes, on Monday, the personal driver of Russian Emergency Situation Minister Sergei Shoigu was fired after a video clip circulated in the internet. The video was recorded by a driver.
And we actually have that tape. Why don't we ask our producer Tanya to play it back for us?
Yeah, the driver says, you jerk, do you want me to shoot your head off or what? In this way, and using his siren on, the driver just trying to clean up his way, avoiding standing in a traffic jam. This is a usual thing, unfortunately, not only in Russia, but in all former Soviet republics, where officials, and especially their drivers, use this siren when it's not necessary to avoid staying in traffic jams. But after this video was shown on the internet, Shoigu, the minister, had to sack his driver, saying, though, that he was not in the car at the moment.
Shoigu wasn't in the car.
He was not.
But the video became viral and everybody in Russia knows about this.
Yes, and it's especially important because the non-governmental organization in Russia called Синие Ведерки, or Blue Buckets, which is fighting against the illegal sirens by officials in their cars, they demand investigations into the case, and they even demand that the driver should be sentenced.
But nobody knows even the driver's name.
Nobody knows. At this point, it was not disclosed.
How interesting. Thank you, Mirhat and Pete. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's our show this week. Thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To find out more about these and other stories, go to our website at rferl.org. If you have any comments, please drop a line to podcast@rferl.org. I leave you with the music of Pakistani singer Atif Aslam. I am Pavel Butorin. Take care.